This week we're going to continue talking about performance. First, some logistical stuff. So we had an exam, and it's been graded, the grades are posted, the median grade after rubric and everything was around 80%. The 25th percentile was around 73, the 75th percentile was around an 87. If you have regrade requests, please submit them soon. I'll probably accept complaints about how things were graded up until very late, but I would much prefer to have them sooner rather than later. Yes? This is adjusted. The raw scores are closer to like 60% median. Okay, so we also have a bunch of labs and homeworks, and I sent an email because the homework briefly had a false statement, which is definitely contradicted by what I said in lecture this morning, and we'll say now. So we have two labs that are new this semester, so probably they'll go okay, but I haven't done them before. So the first one's on loop optimizations, and the second one's on vector instructions, which are something we'll talk about later today. Both of them are new this semester, and they're meant to accompany the homework, but they aren't like part of the homework, like the homework previously implied, that we'd just be working on the homework. That's what we did in previous semesters, but now we have some sort of lab which kind of introduces you to stuff that might be relevant on the homework, maybe. So we have homeworks. Unlike every single other homework in this class, these homeworks can be done in partners or individually. They cannot be done in groups of three. It's two or one. There are two parts to the homework with separate due dates. The first part is to take an image and rotate it. The second part is to take an image and smooth or blur it, meaning you take the average of small blocks of the image. We have given you code which implements this. Your job is to make faster versions of that code. The grade will be on how much faster it ends up being. So let's talk about images. So to represent images, we have pixels. Our pixels are represented with, this structure here. Apparently, I don't have. Apparently, don't get to have a pointing device. Okay. So they're represented with this structure here, which has a red, green, blue, and alpha component. Alpha would represent transparency. Turns out having four components instead of three makes the assignment work a lot better. So that's what we do. The images are represented as flat arrays. So we allocate just a big contiguous array that holds all the little pixels in the image. This means that when you want to get to a certain pixel from an x and a y coordinate, you're going to need to know the dimension and do the multiplication like we saw with our square example in cache blocking. So, rotate means we take an image that looks like this and rotate it. And there's actual code to do it, and there's something funny in this code, which is this RIDX thing. So that looks like a function, and it's kind of like a function. It's actually a preprocessor macro. Preprocessor macros are a feature of C you probably haven't really used. So I'm going to talk a bit about what they are so there's not confusion about what's happening in the code we give you, not because it's actually vital to the assignment in some way as far as what we're teaching you how to do. So preprocessor macros look like this. So here looks like a function when you use it, but it's defined very differently. Say double x should turn into x times 2. So this means that if we do double 100, that turns into 100 times 2. this is literally turns into. The compiler does this text substitution. It doesn't do a function call, and at any point just substitutes one version of this text for the other. And this is true even in cases where it might do bad things. So if you have the same double and you pass 3 plus 3, it's going to take 3 plus 3 and then add times 2 to the end of it. And that's not going to be 6 times 2, that's going to be 3 plus 3 times 2. Which is generally not what someone who wrote that sort of macro would have wanted. So a common thing you'll see, including in the code we give you, is that when people use macros like this, they put some extra unnecessary parentheses in there, because they actually are kind of necessary, to make sure that when you do that text substitution, the order of operations doesn't do something weird. So RIDX is this text substitution. It takes an x, a y, and an n, dimension, and does x times n plus y. So it's coordinate x comma y, and that's how it expands. You do not have to use this macro. You can. You probably will start using it. But you should be aware of how it expands, because it's how things are laid out in memory. And for many of the optimizations we're doing, that's actually important to know. So the textbook authors who made this assignment, the original version, use it because it makes the code kind of more readable than having the multiplications every time. So as I mentioned, the assignment is based on speedup. You can submit multiple variants, multiple possible optimizations in one file, and we encourage you to do that. Also means that when you make a new one, you can not discard your old one. So when you make things slower, you have something to go back to. And we will be measuring the speed up on my machine. My machine has some particular set of caches and a particular version of an Intel processor that might be different than your machines and is different than the lab login machines. Generally, if you see something is substantially faster on your machine, probably it's faster on my machine, but it's not a guarantee. Also, compiler versions can make a difference. You can use the exact same compiler on the lab machines. It's GCC-5. If you want to minimize that, if you want results, you need to have it run on my machine. We have a way where if you submit something, we will show you what the performance results were. Okay. So there are two parts of this assignment, as I mentioned, rotate and smooth. For smooth, we give very specific advice. So this is a change from previous semesters. Previously, we just said make it faster. Now we are requiring you to do vector instructions, which we didn't before. And in exchange, we are giving much, much more specific guidance on what you should do. Though the grading is just on performance, so if you have another way of making it equivalently fast, that is fine. And general advice, especially for rotate, where we don't have very specific advice on what's going to make the code faster, is that our book and lecture mentions lots of things that should make code faster. You should probably try some of them if they seem like they make sense for the problem. You should vary numbers, like when you do loop unrolling, you need to decide how many times to unroll a loop. When you do cache blocking, you need to decide how big cache blocks are. Because something that people run into is that they choose some very bad number, like they do cache blocking with a very small or very large size that doesn't make any difference, and they think, oh, cache blocking is useless. Doesn't mean it's useless, you might have not tried the right version of it. And note that techniques combine well. So if you want to do cache blocking, you might need to do loop unrolling in order for it to really have a big impact. And you should expect that you might need to do multiple things to get a good speed up. Yes?
Didn't you say that the methods were orthogonal to each other, so shouldn't they not have an effect on them?
So orthogonal means that you can combine them and get further away from where you started. But you're asking that you might have to do one to see improvement in the other? That sort of? So, but So we saw the example with cache blocking, where I need to make the loop fast enough that my memory accesses matter. And you might have versions of that effect, where even though the techniques are optimizing different things, something is what's making your code as slow as it is, and you won't see significant improvement until you get rid of that slowness, even though you were still doing something unrelated with the other optimization. Okay. So any questions on the assignments? So last time, we finished up by talking about loop unrolling. So we showed you this example of unrolling a sum, and I showed you some performance numbers based on how many times I unroll things. And you can see here that we got down to a little over one cycle per element we summed up, despite having substantially less instructions being executed. We didn't actually see any improvement in performance. And this isn't because of caching, because I'm working with a small enough array that everything fits in the cache. There's all cache hits. So something else was going on. And this is not something that could have happened with our pipeline processor. With our pipeline processor, unless we had some reason to have more stalling, which we have stalling, which we don't, assuming our ads take one cycle, which they happen to on the machine I was testing this on. There's no reason for stalling, so there wouldn't actually be a reason with our pipeline processor design for this to happen. So something else is going on. And we're going to talk about what about how these processors work gets us to this limit. Why aren't we seeing any improvement even though we're executing less instructions? And even though there's not any reason for us to need to wait for the result of one add, and therefore stall. And so talk about how modern CPUs work. There's sort of two key attributes. That one is that they execute multiple instructions at once. And this means that they execute and start multiple instructions at once. And they also execute these instructions out of order. They just wait for values to be available. It's not like our pipeline where if you have an add and another add, and the first add needs to stall, you can't do the second add any faster. That's not how real processors work. They just say, look at a bunch of instructions and figure out when they can run them as far as actually doing the computation. And one reason for this that we explored earlier is that when you have, say, a long load from cache, you want to do other things. And modern processors have a way of doing this, that while they're having this instruction stall, that they're doing other computations that aren't related. And that's something they're capable of doing. And they're all capable of doing this even in cases where you don't have a stall. They'll look at what values are available and execute instructions that way. So that means modern processors have a bit of a different design compared to the pipeline processor you're used to. So here's a very high-level picture of what a modern processor might be like. So first, we fetch multiple instructions at once. So I'm representing by having multiple sort of fetch stages. So we do multiple instructions fetch at once, and we do our figuring out what the instruction is, pre-processing, which I'm calling the code here, for multiple instructions at once. And then we have this box here called I label an instruction queue. That's the name commonly used for it. And this is a list of pending instructions. So these are instructions we fetched and decoded that we want to run eventually. And what we're going to do from this instruction queue is we're going to look at that list. And whenever the operands for the instructions are available, we're actually going to send them to our ALUs, our load store unit, which is like our cache, and the other various things that actually do the work of the instruction. And we're going to have multiple execution units. So we might have multiple copies of the ALU because we want to run multiple instructions per cycle. You also might have different kinds of ALUs. So you might have a fast ALU that like does adds and a slow ALU that like does divides. And you'll have separate versions of that. The instruction queue is responsible for figuring out what instructions can use what component. You also like have your cache there, your load store unit. And these will vary as far as both what they can do and how fast they work. Some of them might be pipelines, some of them might not be, some of them might have more stages, some of them might have less. Finally, when we get the results of instructions, we collect them in what's called a reorder buffer. So this keeps track of all the values we've computed and tries to figure out, did we finish the first instruction? And if so, it actually writes its result back to registers and all that. And it just waits for things to finish. And the idea is when we finish with this, that this process, this part of the processor before the instruction queue runs in order, like the pipeline you're used to. We are fetch not one instruction at a time, but multiple instructions, and just do them all together in the order they're written in the program. And this part, this part after the reorder buffer here also happens in order. That after we've computed the values, we put things back so we're still doing operations in the order they're done in the program. And that's what the reorder buffer is responsible for doing. In between, we have this complicated logic to figure out what instructions can we run and also to handle forwarding. So I haven't drawn like how forwarding happens, but somehow we're going to take results from finished instructions and send them to other instructions even though we haven't written back the values yet. Just like we forward values in our five-stage pipeline. Except the logic for doing that is way, way more complicated. So questions on this high-level view of how modern processors work. We'll go into like more detail about exactly what the instruction queue is doing in a second. So this is our high-level view. So you can think of the instruction queue as it's a list of instructions. And it's going to keep track of, is the instruction ready, or what instructions is it waiting for? So that's going to be kept track of. And the instruction queue's job is that every clock cycle, it says, what instructions are ready? Let's try to assign as many of them to functional units as possible. So in this example, my execution units, my functional units, are two ALUs. That's where I can put instructions to do their computation. And when I'm starting out, even though I have this pile of nine instructions, only one of them is actually ready to run because the others are waiting for values from instructions we haven't computed yet. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take all the ready instructions, all one of them, and assign that to an ALU. So now it's running. And in this example, our ALUs, just to keep things simple, are going to take one cycle to do their computations. So you don't worry about pipelining or anything like that. So it's running, and I have the second ALU where, well, I didn't find any instructions anywhere in my instruction queue to run, so I'm just going to leave it empty. I'm just going to send a pipeline bubble to that ALU because I just didn't find anything for it to do. So then, eventually, this computation of instruction one finishes. So what we're going to do is we're going to look through our instruction queue and say, what things does instruction one finishing mean we can do now? We're going to say, oh, that means that I can run instruction two. So instruction two is ready now. And we apply the same process we did to begin with. We look at all our ready instructions, all one of them, and assign each one to an ALU until we run out. So during our second cycle, we're going to run instruction two on that first ALU, and we just don't have any work for the second one. And we can repeat this process, and we'll find out that we want to run instruction three. At this point, things get interesting. We have two different instructions that are waiting for the result of instruction three. One of them is this compare instruction, and the other is this add instruction. So when instruction three finishes, they're both going to be right. And that means now, in cycle four, when we're assigning things to our ALUs, we have two things to assign, two ALUs, so we can actually use them both. So we'll end up running both of these instructions at the same time. And they're both going to finish, and when they finish, instruction four is going to finish, which is going to let us run this jump, and running that's going to mean that we're going to check to see if a branch prediction we made is right. Because it doesn't make sense, why do we have instructions after the jump? That's because we did branch prediction already. So everything after the jump is a predicted branch that we're hoping will work out. And if it doesn't, something else in the processor, probably part of the reorder buffer, is going to need to deal with that. But we still need to figure out, look at the condition code and say, is the jump taken or not? And that's what the execution work is going to be. So after instructions 4 and 6 finish, we're going to be able to run instructions 5 and 7. So those two instructions are going to be ready, and we're going to assign them during the next cycle. And sorry, this jump should be running here. And then we're going to finish up instruction 7, lets us run instruction 8. And then instruction 9, and so on. So that's our general procedure, is we just always look at what instructions are ready now, and we assign as many of them as possible to actual functional units. Then whenever an instruction finishes, we say, what instructions are waiting for this, and mark them as ready if everything they're waiting for is done. That's what the instruction queue is doing. And I'm omitting some extra logic here, like dealing with forwarding, so actually sending the values in, dealing with what happens if there's a branch misprediction, that's obviously a whole bunch of extra logic. This is sort of the common case, and this is what you want to know to reason about why things are taking as long as they are. And one thing you'll notice is that we had this scenario here where we had extra functional units, but we couldn't use them. We had this extra ALU, but because our instructions depended on each other, we couldn't take advantage of that. And this is the sort of thing that was happening with my unrolling. That's why I didn't get more performance. So one way of viewing this is with what our book calls a data flow representation. It's showing how does data move between these instructions. So I'm going to draw that as this sort of picture. So I have a box for each instruction, and I have an arrow from one instruction to the other if a value flows from one instruction to the next. So you can see that the first second add depends on the first add 1, 3 depends on 2, and 4 depends on 3, and 6 depends on 3, and so on. So this is just representing the data dependencies between the instructions. There's some tricky cases like the compare. The jump depends on the compare because the compare sets condition codes, which is what are the values that are passed. And there's a general rule when you have this representation, is that if we're imagining time, the arrows must go forward in time. Everything, there's two instructions, there's an arrow between, the thing that's on the other end of the arrow must be after the thing that's before the arrow because of the dependency. Because we need to wait for the result to execute the second thing. And this means that the longest path determines the speed. So the speed at which we can actually do this computation is the speed at which we can do this longest path. We need to do 1, then 2, then 3, then 6, then 7, then 8, then 9. That we can't do it any faster than that because we need to actually handle all those dependencies, and each one of that requires waiting for the previous thing. And this is a useful property for reasoning about performance, because this means that's what you look at to determine how fast things will run. You know, based on that to a first order approximation at least, you can ignore this compare and jump. It obviously matters sometimes because we don't have infinite number of ALUs, we might have a limited number of instructions in the queue, but for the most part, it's just the longest path that sets our performance. So So this is what you want to look at to say, how fast can this loop be? And you want to match up this longest path with what execution units are actually available, where you can actually run the operations for instructions, and how fast that is. And this is how you're going to figure out how fast it could be, what our book calls the latency bound. And that's going to depend on what do these ALUs look like. Can they do an add a cycle? How many of them do we have? Are they pipelined? Are they not? So let's talk about some general kinds of functional units. So there's two big categories. So there's some that are pipelined. So for example, we might have a three-stage ALU, because if we're doing, say, multiplications, that's not very easy to do in one cycle and still have a small cycle time. So real processors might have like a three-stage ALU for multiplies. And this would usually be pipelined. So that means that every cycle we can input a set of values to multiply. And two cycles later, we'll get a value out, which is the result of that multiplication. And this is pipelined, so we can do one multiplication a cycle. But this latency matters when we're worrying about how fast we can actually do computations. So how long, if this is what we're using to do multiplies, does it take to compute this expression? Someone have an answer? Someone have... Yeah.
9 cycles.
9 cycles. So why 9?
It takes a 3-cycle latency for each one of them.
Yeah.
So each time it takes 3 for each one.
Yeah, so it takes 3. So it's, the answer is 9 cycles. It takes 3 for each one. And we need to do them one at a time. We can't take advantage of the pipelining here because we just don't have two multiplies we can do in parallel. They depend on each other, you know, and this is a case where, you know, in our processor, if we had 3 stages of execute, like in the exam, you need to stall. You have that same kind of problem here. So it ends up taking 9 cycles, even though this multiplier, when we have the best scenario, can do 1 per cycle. Here, we're averaging 1 every 3 cycles. And that's because we didn't have parallelism. So part of your job as someone trying to optimize performance is going to be to make sure you can find parallelism and don't have this sort of thing happen. So there's another kind of functional units we'll sometimes have. And that's that, unlike the processor you built for the pipelining assignments, sometimes things take variable amounts of time. So one example was data caches. The data cache, sometimes it's a hit and it's fast. Other times it's going to wait and you're going to need to stall. And to support that sort of thing, you can imagine you have this some functional unit which has this signal telling you, am I ready for my next input? And if that's false, you need to stall in our pipeline design. And also, when am I actually done? And this exists for caches. It also exists for some arithmetic operations. For example, division is really complicated, and many real dividers will do something which, like, internally involves some repeated subtraction of some sort. And that will take different amounts of time depending on what different values are. And because of that, we're not just going to plan for a certain number of cycles. We aren't just going to have a pipeline to handle that. Instead, we're going to send a value. And while that value is being computed on, we're not going to be able to send any more things to divide. That's a common way dividers will work. So you might have functional units like this. And our instruction queue-based design can deal with this because it just knows, it looks at ready instructions and knows what ALUs are available based on signals like this ready signal. And if they're not available, it just doesn't send that instruction out. Okay, so those are kinds of functional units. And we're going to reason about that with our data flow models. So we're going to look at how long each of these takes as far as latency, along with that longest path through the data flow. So let's look at our path through the data flow for our sum example. So let's assume we're doing some unrolling, and this is basically what that data flow is going to look like. It's the same representation I had with the instructions before, and now I'm just not using the instruction names, I'm using operations. And I'm computing the address. This is not quite the most straightforward translation of the C code, but it's equivalent. It's what a good compiler will actually generate most likely. So I have the address computations and also the actual summation. And you can see based on this data flow model that we can basically do three things at once. That if we want this to execute optimally on a processor with enough copies of the ALU, copies of enough ways of inputs to the data cache and so on, we're going to do three operations every second. And since we had about one cycle per element, that's actually what we were getting when I measured that 1.01 cycles per element. And our performance is limited because we have these paths where we need to do these things one at a time. So with this type of loop, we need to do each addition to sum one at a time because each depended on the previous one. And this is what our book calls the critical path. This is what determines how long things must take no matter how many copies of the ALUs and such our processor has. So if we just add up the latency of each of these adds, that's the minimum time we expect, and that's about what we were getting. So the processor I ran that loop unrolling on had an adder which had multiple adders, but each one could do one add a cycle. And because we had a single add we depended on, this is the best I could do on that processor with this design of loop. But we can reorder our operations in order to make this data flow less bad. So here, it's pretty bad because we don't have the optimal parallelism. We have all this stuff which needs to happen one after another. And that generally will give us the situation like you saw with the instruction queue. We have all this time where we have other instructions in our queue, but they aren't ready yet. And we're leaving ALUs unused. So we're going to do better. And we're going to start with a simple example. And this is what our book calls reassociation. So let's say we have one pipelined five-cycle multiplier. And we have these two ways of doing multiplication. So which one is going to be faster? And how long is each one going to take, that multiplier? Write down things if you need to and figure out what you think the answer is, preferably in a number of cycles. And as the hints suggest, one good starting point is to draw the data flow and figure out what's the longest path. who has an answer to either time? Okay, so. Okay, so why would the one on the left be 15?
Because they all need RAX, so they have to be in sequence.
Okay, yeah, so for the one on the left, you know, this is our data flips. For the one on the left, we need to take RAX, multiply it, take the result of that, multiply it, take the result of that, multiply it. So we need to wait 5 cycles to get the first result, 5 cycles to get the second result, 5 cycles to get the third result. And for the one on the right, any other opinions? Yeah.
So the single pipeline, so they can't do it at the same time, they'll just have one and then the next cycle will just next to the second.
Yeah. So you did our critical path analysis, which is what the book suggests, which gives you a nice fast approximation. But when you look at the details here, we just don't have multiple multipliers. So we can't do start multiple at the same time. So that turns out to be 11, because what we have to do to execute this is we say start this multiply in cycle 1, this one in cycle 2, which we can do because they're independent. We don't need to wait, so we can have it go down the pipeline. And then when the one in cycle 2 finishes, in cycle 7, we can start this other multiply. If we had an extra multiplier, we'd get exactly the 10. So this is a case where the critical path doesn't quite give you the time, but it's very close, and it's certainly an easier analysis. And if I had a bigger data flow, then actually figuring out exactly when everything gets scheduled, which, you know, on a real program is extremely impractical. And here, it's one at a time. So we start this at cycle 1, this at cycle 6. This is cycle 11, and finish up at cycle 15. So any questions about what's going on here? Okay, so this idea is, you know, an important concept in optimization, that we're exposing multiple things we can do at once. And to do that, we need to make sure they're actually independent. And then hopefully, because we have a processor has this instruction queue, it's going to figure out I can actually start these two things at the same time. Or do them at least while one is finishing. And this leads us to a better way of doing our summation. So here, I'm computing two sums and adding them together at the end. So now I'm summing up 6 numbers. And with this design, I can do 6 things at once, including 2 actual additions to sums. So I've exposed more opportunity to do multiple things at the same time. And if you want to look at the critical pathway, my critical path basically goes through 4 actual adds to do 7 additions. So we're getting a lot more efficiency in that sense. So we need to wait the time of 4 adds to do these 7 additions, not the time of a much larger, not the time of 7 adds. So we're saving roughly half the time, assuming we can do enough work in parallel. Assuming we have either like adds take multiple cycles and we have a pipeline, or we have multiple adders we can use at once. And what that data flow turns out to look like in C code is something like this. We have 2 sums, we add the even values to sum 1, the odd values to sum 2, and then we add them together at the end. And because those 2 sums are independent, we can compute each of them in parallel, and that's where we're getting our speed up. So I can implement this, for example, and I can also extend this to more than 2 sums, like I can compute 4 at once, or 8, or 16, using the same idea. Just skip over elements and add them up together at the end. So this is what our textbook calls multiple accumulators. And so if I timed that on my laptop, so I started with my 16x unrolled loop, and I just changed the number of accumulators. I started with 1, my original code, then I have two odd and evens, then four, so every first to someone, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, and so on. And measure the performance. So you can see that I got this nice big improvement to 0.57, which is an interesting number. And then things got worse. So any ideas why things got worse when I started adding more and more of these? They didn't just stay the same, they got substantially worse. Yeah.
Register spilling.
So register spilling. So what's that mean? Yeah.
Is it the idea that you start running out of registers to store the local variables and you have to use the stack?
Yeah, so we ran out of registers. So originally our compiler was generating code that, you know, kept the sums in registers. But when we got to 16, it ran out. And so the code it was generating looked like this. We move the value into a register from A, and then we add it to a value we're storing on the stack. And even though everything's a cache hit, absolutely every time, this is more cache accesses and that takes more time. And that's why things got slower. Also, it turned out that I was using already, with less accumulators, all the adders available on my machine, all the time. So there wasn't actually a chance to make it faster by having more parallelism. So the second issue is, what about this peak? Why did we peak at 0.57? Where did that come from? And that's a really strange number. So what number would you expect the peak to be at? And I would know, so I have, so let's figure that, so to figure that out, what do you need to know to know what you'd expect the peak to be at? What information should I tell you about my machine to know what number I should expect it to go down to? Yeah.
0.50.
What? So you're expecting 0.50. Why?
I think it's the latency bound.
So that's a latency bound. So how would you know if that's the latency bound for my machine? So what information would you need to know what the theoretical best I should be expecting from two or four accumulators is? So what should I expect from two? Or if you can't figure out, what do I need to know? You know, how fast should I expect using two accumulators to be? So this is about the longest path. So I want you to know how far long that longest path is. So I need to know how long each operation takes on the path and how big the path is. So with two accumulators, the path is basically, the length of the path is half the number of elements we have to add. And we just need to know how long does each add take as far as latency goes, and the latency of adds on my machine is one cycle. And you also need to know, like, do we run out of ALUs? Like, do we actually have four? And, well, the answer is yes, but we need to compute addresses. So it turns out that we would expect, based on that, that we do two adds to compute addresses every cycle, ideally, and two adds to actually add values. So we'd expect with two accumulators, now that would be using all our adders, and we'd get a performance of 0.5. Because 0.5 means that we're doing two useful adds to actually adding to the sum a cycle. And that would be the latency of those adds. And we're getting worse than that. So what's happening? And this is related to loop overhead. So I started with a 16 exon rolled loop, and my compiler generated four instructions to manage the loop. So it had an add, a subtract, a compare, and a branch. And even though my machine could do these four adds at a time, one to compute the address for each element, one compute to add to the sum for each element, and do those all four at a time, we had to pay for the loop overhead. And that meant that you know, the loop overhead instructions needed ALUs, they did additions and subtractions and comparisons. And that extra cost of that loop overhead is what counts for the extra 0.07. So that's something which might be improved by doing even more loop unrolling. Loop unrolling, which didn't help before because we weren't actually getting the full parallelism due to the latency, you know, longest path issue. So any questions about multiple accumulators in general? Yes.
Yeah, does 0.07 cycles per moment really make a negligible difference?
It depends how many elements you have. The question is, does 0.07 make a difference? Depends how many elements you have. Like, it's a 14% difference, so there are cases where you care about that and cases where you wouldn't. The main thing I want to point out is that you can actually figure out why you're getting exactly that performance. You know, it's not mystery box. There are parts of processors which are like that, where it's very hard to figure out what's going on. This is not actually one of them. Okay. So we're going to talk about a completely different type of optimization that's, well, it's related. It's about parallelism, but it's a very different kind of parallelism. And this is with vector instructions. So with multiple accumulators and reassociation, you're talking about having the processor do two different instructions that were independent of each other at the same time. Modern processors have these special registers that hold multiple values, hold a vector of values, a little mini array. For example, x86-64 has a series of 128-bit registers, and you can use those to hold 4 ints, 4 floats, 2 doubles, 8 shorts, and lots of other things that fit in 128 bits. They're named XMM0 through XMM15. You may have seen this in some sort of assembly code you were reading somewhere. And there are instructions which treat it as this array of values and act on all those values, all the entire array of values. These are called vector instructions, or sometimes SIMD for single instruction, multiple DDAP instructions. And to make these instructions efficient, modern processors typically have extra copies of the ALUs, essentially. So they take the same amount of time as an instruction that just acts on one value. So now you have this one instruction which adds 4 32-bit values and takes essentially the same amount of time as an instruction which adds one 32-bit value, one pair of 32-bit values. So, for example, PADD is an instruction which stands for packed add D-word, D-word for double word, which is Intel's funny term for a 32-bit value. And as I said, XMM registers are 128 bits, so as 32-bit values, they can store 3 of them. So if XMM0 contains the 32-bit values 1, 2, 3, 4, which means the first 32 bits of it are the value 1, the second 32 bits are the value 2, the third 32 bits are the value 3, and so on. And XMM1 contains 5, 6, 7, 8. This instruction will produce 6, that's 1 plus 5. 8, that's 2 plus 6, 10, that's 3 plus 7, and 12, that's 4 plus 8 in its result. And it will do this in roughly the same amount of time it would take to do a single add of two normal 32-bit values in, you know, EAX and EDX. And this is a thing compilers could take advantage of. So with this very carefully written code up here, I have managed to get some version of, I think, GCC to generate this code that uses the vector instructions. So it loads 128 bits from A and B, that's 4 elements, into one of these 128-bit wide registers. Then it uses the instruction to add 4 elements together, and then it stores the result back into A. Then it adds 16 to its pointer to where it's currently is in each of these arrays. So that's going by 4 ints worth of space. And checks for the end of the loop. And because this instruction takes roughly the amount of time a 32-bit ad would, this is basically 4 times faster than the straightforward code for adding 32-bit values. So another way of looking at it is this is what's going on. Our compiler loads, say, B4 through B7 into a register, A4 through A7 into a register, and PID takes the sum of each pair, puts it in the register, and then that's stored back into, I believe, A. And this can be combined with normal loop optimizations too. I just didn't have that happen in that example. And we've in fact sort of seen this before. So you remember when I was talking about cache optimizations, I showed you graphs like this of my performance. And this has like lots of like spiky lines, and no one really commented about that's really weird, something bad's going on. And what was going on here is that my compiler actually used this optimization. I got it, convinced it to use this optimization of these types of vector instructions. And it was doing 8 things at a time. And when things lined up with the that 8 size, it was a lot faster. And when it didn't, it was a lot slower. And that's what this each spike is. Every spike is 8 wide because of the effect of this optimization. So to implement this, the basic idea is you take your ALU and you have multiple lanes, one for each computation, and you just feed a value, you know, your set of values into each of the lanes. And they all happen in parallel. This is physically parallel on the hardware, and this is actually really simple to build. And the big reason why processor designers actually want to do this has a lot to do with limitations of that sort of modern processor design we've seen before. So if we look at this picture here, we have all this logic. We have our fetch, our decode, this big instruction queue, this reorder buffer to handle writing the values back. So you have lots and lots of logic, including a bunch of stuff that's not shown here to make sure forwarding and branch prediction all work correctly. So we're spending all this space on our chip not to do computations. And if you have space on your chip, then you can just add vector instructions by making your ALUs basically just bigger, making copies of them. And you need only a very small amount of extra control logic, because it's basically the same as the scalar instructions. So you don't need very much extra control logic. And you can make your processor be able to do a lot more computation with a relatively small investment compared to adding all that extra control logic to do multiple things at once. And this is why it's really attractive for modern processors to do this. So questions on the hardware side of vector instructions. So I've seen that sometimes compilers generate this faster code. So here we have the straightforward 4-at-a-time code generated. Here the compiler figured out how to optimize my square function. And we can see that both in the absolute performance and the squiggles. But you know, it's not consistent. So compilers sometimes can figure out how to do this. And they've gotten a lot better in the past like decade or so. They used to be really, really bad at this. Now they get it a lot of the time. You know, we just put a lot of effort into making the compilers figure out how to use these instructions, especially as they become more common. Vector instructions are actually very, very old. They date back to the 80s. But compilers took a long time to catch up, and this is one of the reasons why they didn't catch on for a very long time. But compilers, while they do a better job than they used to, they still very often mess up. So aliasing makes it really hard to do this because you want to do two adds in parallel, which means you need to know the two pairs of values you're adding aren't dependent on each other. And that's often hard for compilers to prove if there might be aliasing. Conditionals make it hard. If you have a conditional in your loop, that means you sometimes want to add, sometimes not, but that's not what the instruction does. It just always adds four pairs of values. You need to handle that. That's very hard for compilers to deal with. Not all operations have a straightforward vector instruction. For example, there's no vector divide instruction for integers. So if you have that, the compiler either needs to figure out how to write that with other instructions or not use vector instructions. And these sorts of challenges, in addition to the general thing of finding a pattern where you can use vector instructions, means that compilers are a bit fickle about actually doing this. This might improve over the next couple years, it might not. So for example, GCC 7.2 and Clang 5, which are the latest released versions of these compilers, will generate vector instructions for the first loop and not the first function and not the second one. And you can figure out what's different. And it's not that it's not possible to generate good version of the second function with vector instructions. It is. They just don't see it. And you can see we've changed like the loop index on the last A and the order of the loops. That's all we've changed. And this sort of thing is common. It's really hard to guess without just trying whether a compiler is going to know how to vectorize something. There's lots of cases where this sort of thing comes up, where sometimes the compiler figures it out and it's great, it saves you lots of time. Other times, if you want it to happen, you might need to do extra work. Another example, like Clang 5 generates vectorized code for the first one, not the second. The only thing I changed is whether the loop indices are ints or longs. Probably a bug, but this is the sort of thing you might run across when you try to have compilers do this. Not very fun. So there's other ways of getting at vector instructions. So obviously you could write assembly. I showed you, we generate assembly with them. You could write that by hand. There's this second option which Intel has advocated and appears in other places, of intrinsic functions, which are a name for C functions that are going to compile down to not a function call, but a particular instruction. And the idea here is that you can write most of your code like C code, so the compiler can deal with like loop indexing and incrementing pointers and all that. But you can actually use these vector instructions by telling the compiler explicitly, I want to use the add four pairs of values instructions here. And it will definitely do that. You're telling it exactly what to do, so it's not going to mess that part up, but it can still do the rest of the optimizations and code generation for you. So it's a lot more convenient than writing assembly, even if maybe you can't tweak the last little bit of performance out of it. So let's look at what these vector intrinsic functions, the ones that Intel has defined for their instructions, look like for our add example. So I showed you the automatically vectorized version. I'm going to show you the manually written version. What you'd have to do if for some reason the compiler didn't figure it out and you didn't want to just write assembly. So this is what it looks like, and this is really intimidating because Intel has some really bad naming choices. So everything starting with _mm is a built-in function that basically corresponds to a specific instruction. The things starting with __m are a type that corresponds, in this case, to values which we kept in one of those 128-bit registers. So this __m128i, is 128 bits of integers. And hopefully, each of those variables with this type will be kept in an XMM register. If you use too many of them, just like an int, the compiler will spill it to the stack. It's 128 bits wide, so in this case, it's holding four ints in one variable. We also need pointers to this type because the load functions we're using here expect a pointer to 128 bits of stuff. So we take our array element and convert it to a pointer to 128 bits, which means not just AI, but AI, AI plus 1, AI plus 2, AI plus 3, because that's 128 bits worth of stuff from A, starting at AI. So we have these load functions, which have some funny things in their name. So the SI128 is the thing Intel puts in the function names when they deal with 128-bit number, integer-like number. And the U means that it's unaligned. Otherwise, you have those restrictions on the values you can pass. So these correspond to the move instructions, exactly to the instructions that move from memory into an XMM register or back. And these will generate exactly those instructions. So then we have this add function here. And this corresponds to that PADD instruction I showed you earlier. So it says add four 32-bit integers. The EPI 32 is Intel's very funny way of saying this function acts on four 32-bit signed integers. So that will generate the PID function. So this, when compiled, will basically generate that assembly code I showed you earlier with the moves to load things into XMM registers, the PID to add four pairs of 32-bit values, and the move back into memory. But we've done it by hand, and this is what you would do if for some reason the compiler didn't figure that out. Or in a more complicated case where the compiler couldn't figure it out. So I've shown you this example. So this deals with adding 32-bit values. It turns out that there are multiple versions of these instructions, and therefore multiple versions of the intrinsic. So for example, I can change this to act on, instead of pairs of four values at a time that are 32 bits, two values at a time that are 64 bits, fits in the same register, and it turns out there's an instruction that adds two pairs of 64-bit values, which has a different name, and has a corresponding function, which has EPI 64 instead of 32. So, questions on what's going on in this code? Besides why Intel chose such ridiculous names for everything that are really ugly and hard to read. Okay, so let's look at applying this to our familiar example of our square function. To give an example, how we want to take something which is not so obvious as add all pairs of values together and turn it into a vectorized function. So to start out with this, and the typical thing you'll do when you want to figure out how do I take advantage of these vector instructions for my function, is you'll want to unroll it a bit and try to, you know, expose the vector operation. So here I'm unrolling it four times, and the idea is that hopefully I can do these four lines of very similar looking code with those vector instructions. That there's four adds, hopefully I can do them with one of that add four pairs of values instruction. There's four multiplies, hopefully there's a multiply four pairs of values instruction I can use. So the idea is I'm lining this up with the hope that I'll figure out how to take advantage of those instructions. And if I had trouble doing this, maybe I try rearranging the loops to make it work better or something like that. But in this case, this organization will work. And we're going to need some functions that I haven't shown you before, which have corresponding instructions. So one of them, there's an intrinsic function for loading four copies of a 32-bit value into a 128-bit register or value. The instructions generate vary, but you know, there's some instructions that do this that this corresponds to. And there's also one for multiplying two 32-bit values together and giving you four pairs of 32-bit values and giving you four 32-bit results, and that's this MULLOAD. So given that we know those exist, you could look them up in the documentation. We're going to figure out how to convert this step by step into vectorized code. And I'm just going to work on this inner loop. The idea is I'm going to figure out how to do this little piece with vector instructions. And you know, that's just going to be in my loop. And then later on, I can say, try to apply loop optimizations to that or do other optimizations in addition to this vectorization. So our first observation, so we have this piece of code we think looks like it's doing four things at once. So you can do it with those do four things at once instructions. And we need to look at what we need to do. So first, we have these B values. We need to load them and store them. And to load them, it turns out they're all adjacent in memory. And that's very helpful because the only load instruction I've shown you loads four values, well, loads 128 bits from memory that's all together. You need to do something more complicated if they weren't adjacent. But since they are, we can do this one load instruction will load the I times n plus j plus 0 plus 1 plus 2 plus 3, since that's 128 bits altogether into one of our registers, in this case represented by a variable bij. And when we're done, we're going to somehow change bij, and we're going to store the value back into those 128 bits. We also need to load values from A around k times n plus j. Those are also adjacent in memory, so we'll use this one load instruction and load 128 bits worth of values. And that's going to be four elements in this case because we have 32-bit elements of A. Then we need to load A of I times n plus k and multiply it. So we don't want to load A of I times n plus k and the things after in memory. We actually want to load four copies of it. And we want to take each copy and multiply it by a different thing from the other part of it. So that's where this set one is going to be useful. So that says take this 32-bit value and make four copies of it. So you make those four copies ready to multiply, and then we use our multiply four things at once instruction. And this use case shows you the sort of reason why there's this set one intrinsic function and instructions that support it, because this is a pretty common sort of thing to want to do, take one value and apply it to multiple things. And this is the pattern they support to make that efficient. So then we get the results of the multiplications, and our last step is we need to add it back to B. And that's just the same add four pairs of values instruction we saw before once we have the results of the multiply. And if we put that all together, we get this, which is ugly. It's just all those steps put together. You could construct that step by step and get that result, and that's the vectorized version that my compiler happened to figure out. This is how you do it if it didn't. Okay. So questions about anything I did here? Okay, so this is the basic strategy for using these intrinsic functions. So I note that there are other vector instructions. So I'm showing you the extensions to the x86 instruction set, which named with SSE. There's also some more recent ones. I'm not showing you them because I'm showing you what our lab machines support and what we're going to have you use in the lab and the homework, because we want everyone to be able to actually run them. More recent versions have wider vectors, junior, and also a bit more flexible instructions. And there are other vector instruction sets on different architectures, including machines which are designed around doing vector instructions well, which will have features that make things more convenient in general, like better conditional handling or variable length instructions. Interesting. Okay. I guess I thought I had another slide, but I guess I don't. So if I have it, it's going to be next time. So that's vector instruction. So we'll have you do that for the lab next week. We're going to start you off with a very simple, we're going to start you off with that add function, a version of it, and have you do some examples with that. And also, for the second part of the performance homework, we're giving you specific instructions on what to do, because you're going to do everything people did in prior semesters and also make it use vector instructions. But we give you the instructions on what people were supposed to do in prior semesters, so you don't need to figure it out, which hopefully makes the assignment shorter. Yes?
Can you go over the quiz question and the exception handler?
Okay, so the question is, there was a quiz question about exception handlers. And I believe, let me pull up the quiz. So the quiz. So the quiz was this quiz. Okay, so the last question, I believe. Yeah, so exception handlers. Are functions. So I think, so the most popular answer is a special kind of process. So a process has some things. It has the illusion, it has its own CPU and its own memory. It has an address space. This is not something exception handlers have. Exception handlers explicitly access things in the program that was running. And they're part of the OS, and we don't like set up a new environment for them. So they aren't processes. But they are functions. They have a different calling convention than normal functions because the processor calls them in a slightly different way. It saves extra stuff. But they're functions, but they're not processes because they don't have their own. They don't have the illusion they have the CPU to themselves. They don't have the illusion they have their own address space, especially because they explicitly manipulate what processes are running. So they aren't a process themselves. Because like the timer, on a timer exception, we're gonna stop what's running and run something new. We're changing what processes are running. That's what the exception handler is doing. It's not really part of either of the two processes.
Okay.
Or if it is part of a process, the process it's a part of is the operating system process. It's not a process itself.
Okay.
Because it has the address space of the operating system because it needs to access all the operating system data structures.